I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Guys, I've been looking forward to this for weeks. We are hanging out with our boy, Quajo, the director of critical care at the Ottawa Hospital. And for folks who aren't aware, like Quajo, you've been, I think this might be your third time on the show.
Third, I think, yeah.
Ain't no rookie. And we ain't talking no rookie today, boys. No,
this is it. This is it. You're a vet here at Sick Boy Studios.
Amongst being the producer and creator of your own podcast.
That's right. That's right. We had the pleasure of running into you in the Ottawa airport a couple of months ago when we were there. We did a live show. We get to the airport. We see this guy going through security. We're like, we know this guy. And we walked up. We had like just an amazing little chat as we were walking to our gates. And it sparked the inspiration for us to get you back on the show, because actually there's something that I've been okay. So folks, if you aren't aware, Quajo, can you tell folks what is your TikTok? Because you're kind of getting a big deal on TikTok. So just like real quick, give yourself a TikTok plug, and then I want to set up the reason why I wanted to have this conversation with you today.
Oh man, so thank you, gents, for having me. And by the way, that trip. So you guys, I got to see you guys in the airport, but that trip was straight up bullshit. Got stuck in Toronto and couldn't get back home, but ended up taking a ferry. No, I made that up. Train. the TikTok, I was an anti-TikTok folk for the longest time. People had a group that came up to me and said, like, you know what, you might do okay on TikTok. And I'm like, I ain't dancing and shit. I ain't pointing in directions and so forth.
You look good, though. You're doing it right now. Looks good.
I'm versatile. So I give this a try. I'm like, okay, well, we'll do a couple of videos and see what happens. And the thing blew up. It really just blew. Yeah. I had no idea what I was getting into. And before you know it, in a few months, you get over 100,000 followers, and now I think we're over 300. And at Quacast, and I had no idea things were going to go like this. Yeah. I had no idea.
So have your dancing skills improved then?
Oh, I mean, there's no dancing. I'll dance on this show a little bit if you need me to. But like,
you're not busting out the gritty on TikTok.
Only my boys. Only my boys will throw that down. I can't gritty yet.
So, so on TikTok, you know, you've got two big doctors on TikTok. You got the Dick Doc on TikTok.
Yep.
And you got the Quadcast on TikTok. So, you know, if you're following the Dick Doc, I get it. But take a moment, open up your app, and go follow at Quadcast on TikTok, because it is worth it. And here's the thing: this is the reason why I wanted to get you on, because I don't use TikTok that often, actually, really at all. I'm more of an Instagram guy. But a lot of times you will take your TikToks and you'll post them on Instagram. We see that a lot with Instagram. A lot of people like use it to sort of
cross promo.
This is the most millennial boomer thing you've ever said. Like I don't watch TikToks. I only rewatch them on when they're cross posted on Instagram.
Yeah, no cap. That's me busting. But you put up a post. I mean, it was a while back, but you kind of post about this every so often, and it was a post specifically relating to racism in the workplace, in healthcare. And that's something that we've kind of like glossed over here and there over the last couple of years, speaking with healthcare professionals, but we never really like took a deep dive into it. And that's kind of one of the things that I really want to like touch on with you today, Quajo. For people that don't like follow us on social media or just listen and don't, you know, watch our YouTube videos or whatever. Quadjo, you are a black man working in the healthcare system.
Darkness.
I know that like you yourself have faced racism in the workplace, and it's something that is, you know, that you are trying to voice and get, you know, awareness out there. So with that, I guess maybe I'll throw it to you and just give us a little bit of insight into what that looks like for you, racism in healthcare specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, growing up in Edmonton, you kind of have a you have a racist existence. Like you experience racism at a very early age. For me, as early as 4 or 5 years old, being called the N-word, all these kind of things. And it's one of those perceptions that you think as you go into healthcare, as you go into these more professional settings, that it's going to dissipate, like it's going to not exist. And I haven't been too vocal about it as a trainee. Even though I've been in situations where they ask me, like, when's a real doctor going to come in the room? I've been called the N-word straight up by a patient. Like, I've even as department head, I've been, I remember I was just described as the chief of the department, and they're like, chief of what? Like, chief of what African tribe are you talking about? Like, Jesus, it just Christ. Clearly, like, you know, like people still have racist point of perspectives. You know, George Floyd happens, and you know, we've seen a lot of situations with police brutality, but this was something different around this time. Like, maybe it was COVID energy because we were all stuck at home, but the way George died, the way he was treated like an animal, the way he was begging for his life, he was begging for his mom. And we just witnessed him over a 9-minute period die slowly. That was triggering. And it was that, an episode that we did with Chika Oriwa, who's like the valedictorian and helped produce a black program for medical school at U of T. I just felt like I got to be more vocal about this shit. And then you've experienced stuff, you see stuff, you see how, whether it is black people that get treated in hospital, you see how the indigenous population gets treated in hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it was just like, enough. Fuck this. Like, enough. Enough of this ignorance, enough of these side comments, enough of these people being treated this way. And I don't know. I won't lie to you boys, like, I don't love talking about this because it is triggering or whatever. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's like, I have a voice. I have an ability to bring awareness to many of these issues, and I'm going to try and make a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, collectively, we're going to try and make a difference.
Is it hard to feel that like pressure of feeling like, you know, you have a sort of platform and this opportunity to speak about these issues, but like almost feeling like you have that responsibility and that you have to sort of try to live up to it in the best way. But like also, I imagine probably not even really knowing at times like what to say or how to do that. Like, does it feel like a bit of this like weight that you have to bear?
That's a really good question. And part of it is, yes, like you do. There is a weight there that you have a responsibility for your people to try and influence things and rise them up and motivate, you know. And you know, sometimes they ask you like a lot of policy questions in healthcare. How do we increase our diversity and inclusion? Blah blah. Yeah. I'm like, I ain't an expert in this shit. I just have a lived experience and give you an opinion, but I ain't an expert in it. But at the same time, because of, I don't know, I was in mid-career when I started to be more vocal in this. Like, I'm, you know, well into my 40s. And when I hear about, say, when I did that interview with Chika Oriwa, she was a medical student being an activist. And I'm like, man, this wasn't even on my radar to be vocal about these kind of issues. And so I'm in some ways trying to make up for lost time.
Right.
I'm like, holy cow, man, I gotta step up my game.
When you say that, does that come and like Does that come from a place of like when you were younger, maybe in medical school or like in your residency or something like that? Is there a sense from your perspective of like I see this happening around me, but you know, I don't want to rock the boat. I'm early in my career. I don't have the credibility or the reputation to be stepping outside the box, quote unquote, and raising these issues for fear of not being reprimanded, but causing people to feel a certain way about you, that you are rocking the boat, that you're shaking things up. Like, is that a feeling that you have, or maybe subconsciously in retrospect?
Huge. You nailed it. Like, that's absolutely it. It's like this inability to be authentic because you got to play a role in some ways. Like, and you also got to realize, you know, it's a little different now, but being in Edmonton, doing all this stuff, like being, you know, like where there wasn't tons of diversity in terms of being Black, like your eyes are always on you. Like they're always on you. So you, like, you're aware of that. Like, the way you react to a certain thing, the way you, like, the way you are in terms of patient care, like, people notice you. And so you always have to be on. And when you're on, you got to be in a way that people find acceptable. And which is really hard, if I'm being honest with you, because you're not being your authentic self. So we started a Black mentorship program. And this is one of the main messages I send, like, if you want to be well, if you want to, you know, deal with your overall wellness as you go through the ranks, you got to try and stay as authentic as possible. And it's okay. You know, this is why I felt the need to be in a higher level, you know, like get a seat at the table when it comes to administrative roles, being on a board, like, so you could advocate for these kids that are coming through and want to be themselves. They're wearing what they want to wear because that's cultural. That's okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember some kid coming into the ICU or whatever, or he's wearing a backpack. Like, you know how like all the ball players are wearing backpacks everywhere. Maybe this is like, you know, not
like the string backpacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And someone's saying like, what the fuck? And I'm like, no, what the fuck? No, it's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with what this kid's doing. Like, just is he professional at work? Is he treating people with respect? Is he smart? Yes, leave that kid alone.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, it's like, so honestly, that is a big part of the issue. Like, the other thing too is when you're early in your career, you're dependent on people's like positive letters and positive references to get to the next step. So as a med student, you're trying to get into residency. In residency, you're trying to get into fellowship. When you get fellowship, then you're trying to get into your staff job or the real job. So you're always trying to please. You're always trying to perform. And so, you know, that's another reason why it's been always a bit of a challenge to show your true colors.
Yeah, I
imagine that another part of like the racism, experiencing racism, is the frustration of feeling like the responsibility is put on Black folks to try to educate people to change, when the people who need to change they're the ones who are being ignorant or need to learn something. And so, like, I would imagine that it feels like a burden that's being put on you because of the ignorance of somebody else. And you're like, well, fuck, why do I have to spend my energy trying to educate these people or fix this situation, when really it's that person who needs to be doing the work? Do you feel any part of that?
That's exactly on point. Like, even this like DEI movement, you know, like, who are they looking for to be the diversity officer of the hospital or whatever organization? It's usually the person of color. I'm like, I'll speak for myself. I don't want anything to do with this. Like, I got my research is in how to save healthcare dollars. It's on how to be more efficient in our system, how to look at preventative medicine. Ooh. I don't want to go and talk to a bunch of groups and say like, why you got to use these terms to be more inclusive and all that stuff. That's not me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is it generally, and not just in healthcare, but kind of like across the board, I'm having this thought now, maybe for the first time, I think, is it insane to assume that a person of color is the person that has the information to teach people. Like, as if you, as if like just by the nature of the color of your skin that you've like, you just like inherently have this like skill to teach people not to be racist. Like, it's like, it's kind of nuts. Is it?
Yeah.
Hey, he's black. He's a specialist. He's the black specialist. Yeah. You know? He fucking knows.
It's true. It's like, they explain, like, how do I teach my kid how to be less ignorant? I'm like, I don't know, motherfucker. Google it.
Yeah, you're like, I'm a doctor.
You're like, you're putting all this more pressure on me. That's what race, you know what it is? Racism is pressure. Like, I think of my son. So he got called the N word a few months ago. Part of the story when these incidents happen that people don't appreciate is how much pressure is on you for your reaction. Like, what's K gonna do now? Is he gonna bust that kid's head open? Yeah. Is he gonna just cower? Is anybody gonna speak up? Is like, what, how do you handle that? What if the guys, you know, back in the day when you're on the ice, when someone throws down, they're like, well, if this guy's 220 pounds, and at the time I'm 160 wet, maybe. And am I supposed to throw down now that he called me the N word? So my teammates gonna step up? So like that was part of the you know, there was many emotions when I heard my son got called that, but then I just felt bad for him. Like the whole class heard it, and he's got to now save face somehow, and knowing that, you know, that, you know, his innocence has left him a little bit. Now he knows real for the rest of your days, unless stuff really significantly changes, like you're going to be judged on how on the color of your skin. And, you know, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jesse Cruikshank.
Jesse Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
I would like to kind of shift the conversation a little bit. To something else that, and maybe this is in your wheelhouse, but if you do feel cool with talking about it, I would love to get your thoughts. But one thing that I've been seeing more and more, especially through probably just through the echo chamber that is like what we do and the people that we follow and that we listen to, is, you know, I'm seeing a lot of headlines where like Naheed Dasani talks about this a lot, but how like racism and discrimination are like key public health threats. And I'm wondering like what your take is on that. Like what is it that makes racism or discrimination, in what ways does it make it a public health threat?
Yeah. So I'm going to preface this by saying like, this is just my interpretation of some of that speak. And I think the way I like to illustrate that is through even our COVID reaction. So say if you look at who was most likely to contract COVID, who was most likely to be hospitalized with COVID, die from COVID, who was most hurt by our restrictions. So you're going to lock down, but make sure the essential workers have to work at that Amazon factory and then come home to a multi-generational home and spread their COVID like crazy. And they have nowhere to isolate and they don't have paid leave option. They have not easy access to testing. You know, they look much like me or derivative of me. If you look at school closures and how that's going to impact what population that's going to hit the hardest, you know what I'm saying? And like, you know, many of these people are going to have to choose between, hey, do I educate my kid or do I put food on the table? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? When you look at vaccine mandates, who do they affect the hardest? When you look at when people lose their jobs as it relates to mandates, what do they look like? Mm-hmm. You know, like all this, if we were going to take like a really look at an equity lens, maybe we'd take it a little bit more seriously. Mm-hmm. Like we just did a show. I don't know when this is going to come out, but But we did a show mid-January with a live cast with Stefan Burrell and Suman Chakrabarty and Zane Chagla about like lessons from COVID and how we're going to handle the next one. And I'll tell you this much, you got to like let the data dictate the policy. We got to let the data dictate how we're going to respond.
Yeah.
Got to depoliticize this shit and focus on who is of greatest need and hit them up with the resources. You know what I mean? Like, Jesus, like if people, the middle class had to, or if they lost their internet or they lost their ability to Uber Eats, you think we would be locked down as long as we were? You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. all these policies affect racialized people the most. And because it's people that don't have as much of a voice or people that can sometimes be looked at as second-class citizens, we don't do shit.
Mm-hmm.
We don't rise it up. And so, yeah, that's why I think when you say, like, racism is, in my opinion, like, is a public health issue, that's where my head goes. I'm not sure, like, I can't read Sandy's viewpoint, but that's where my brain goes.
That totally makes sense to me. And I also want to say, like, I feel, maybe I'm wrong here, but I do feel like COVID really was like one of the key factors in making that so fucking apparent to everybody mm-hmm. across the country.
It provides a really good vignette of like what's happening even pre-COVID, but it's like, hey, here's a fucking big shit storm where all of these things are problems are amplified.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to see them. But I think to your point, Quadro, about the about data dictating the policy, hopefully the hope is that if anything good comes out of COVID, it's that we learn from this stuff and actually apply it to make change.
I hope so, brother, because we can't do this twice. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of us were saying, like, I'm not as attuned to it, but my colleagues who are infectious disease doctors saying, like, I mean, another version of a pandemic, we're probably 5-6 years away from that, whether it's bird flu or whatever it might be. And we cannot like approach this the same way. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
I mean, from every direction, it was from every direction, no matter what side of the conversation you were on, it was shit.
Do you see any change happening? Like, have any substantial or significant changes happened that you've seen as a result of COVID?
Yeah, there are some positives that I think are going to come out of it, if I'm being honest. Like the leveraging virtual care, I think is smart. Like, there's not, in Ontario, it gets a bit of a bad rap because some people's hard to see their family doc and they're hiding behind the screen or whatever. But then there's a lot of situation where it's super beneficial. Like, you know, if you think you're out in Dartmouth or I'm just making up places in Nova Scotia.
That's where I grew up.
I had a feeling. Imagine you got to see that specialist for basically a 5-minute appointment, but you're going to take the time off work, find parking, all this stuff. Whereas easily we could be looking at each other via a screen and just make sure everything is proper and then move on with your day. Or the other extreme of that is you are at, you want to see one of the best specialists regarding whatever condition. Now you have access to them. You don't have to travel. You could just be in front of your computer and get that level of expertise. And then there's another project that we're launching in April, which is leveraging virtual care is we have a virtual critical care program. So say,
oh, wow.
You're in Halifax, someone's sick in Dartmouth, you're going to have access to someone like me saying, hey, you're going to want to give them more fluid. You want to try this antibiotic. You want to do this and that. They look really bad anyway. Let's bring them early. Or you could try this stuff so they could you could stay in Dartmouth and get the interventions you need. Yeah. So like there's a lot of – that's a good side. What else is good? I think also we have – maybe pivoted a bit in terms of how resistant we are to change. Like I think within critical care, or not just critical care, but in medicine in general, we're dinosaurs when it comes to new innovation.
Yeah.
I think COVID kind of took off the veil for that to a certain degree, and I hope we continue that. Yeah. And just like Yeah, I think those are the kind of the main ones that come to mind. But and just hopefully just next time we're not going to be so restrictive in people's dialogue. Like, it was, like even using the term, like I'm just trying to think of what terms were controversial. Being like mentioning myocarditis was a bad thing.
Oh, yeah.
At one point, just any concerns that was against the narrative at some point was like you would be. Persecuted.
I just read an article yesterday from CBC that was like a collection of stories of people who had I think in particular it was like a skin rash that developed after they got the vaccine. And from what I understand, I mean, like, you know, not life threatening, but like something that
not great.
That was not good, and something that they were concerned about, and was uncomfortable, and had an impact on their lives and work and whatever. And it was basically this collection of stories of people going, you know, I went to my doctor and I said that I had, you know, I had just gotten the vaccine and I got the skin stuff, and that anyone that they told that to, it was kind of like, ooh, like. We don't want to hear about that. Like, we don't want to do. And it was kind of, and they were, and these people in all these stories, they were going, we're not saying we don't want the vaccine. We don't think the vaccine is helpful. We don't think we should get it. We don't think other people should get it. They were just going, I put something this in my happened. Body and I got a rash and I want to take care of the rash. Like, why do I have to feel like,
sounds like Aaron Rodgers to me.
Why do I have to feel demonized? I don't fucking know, man. Why do I have to feel demonized with this? And I was reading those stories and I felt like a little kind of pinch in my own heart, because I felt like at one point of the evolution of that whole conversation, I might have been in that camp of like, oh, come on, like it's a rash, like you get the vaccine, the bigger picture, think about the. Now I'm a dad, and I'm a change, and I'm changed.
I guess, like, Quadra, to you, like, has the politicization of the health of medicine and the healthcare process, is that something that's new since COVID? Like, has that become a bigger deal or problem to deal with since COVID?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, maybe it's one of those things that was maybe happening and I just was less aware, but to this scale, I can't imagine there's been anything close to that. Like, I'm thinking, you know, maybe there was stuff with HIV treatment or something back in the day, but this was ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
This got ridiculous.
And it still is. Like, I mean, honestly, Quadra, like, one of my favorite things to do with your social media, other than watching it and taking it in and appreciating it, is reading the fucking comments. Dude, your comment section. Holy shit. You want to see people get riled up? Go to a Quadro video and just watch.
Wait, why?
Oh my god! You'll have someone get on there and go, "Speak it." That's it. This is the man right here. The next comment would be like, "This fucking cuck." Like, as if he's putting this shit out. Like, it's really crazy to see these types of comments. These types of like super polarized comments on a video that is literally just putting out like good, interesting public health information, and then you see the way that it just triggers people,
becomes political,
and they become it immediately becomes left or right, fucking,
it's
like
crazy.
You know,
honestly,
fuck Trudeau, like, you know, you're just seeing you're like, what the fuck is going on here?
Do you see a difference in that now, Quadro? Like, I personally feel maybe it's just because I'm not paying attention to it anymore. Like, I'm not digesting it nearly as much as you know this time last year. Do you find that it's calmed down a little bit, or
definitely calmed down? Like, I mean, the worst of it was last February or January or February last year. We were talking about, you know, we were just being more doing a lot of advocacy for getting kids back to school, and so it got vicious. Like, there was on Twitter there was a Lego picture of my family, which was really spooky because it was like the table we sit at, like, it was like, I don't know if they must have seen a picture somewhere or they know somebody, but it was way too personal, saying, hey, you know, this is the doctor that everyone's saying to listen to, and just being, just really being vicious. And, you know, it's one thing to throw shade towards me, but when you get my family involved too, then, you got to step off. But, you know, I'm honestly, like, Jerry, I'm good at not reading the comments. And
I'll read them for you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And, I just don't know what happened to us. Like, that's what's scary. Like, I want to put things in perspective for everyone, like you guys and the listeners. Like, in the pandemic, when things got busy, it affected my life significantly. So, like, if I, as an example, in the third wave, when I'm having to sleep in hospital, our staff are burned out. We're taking care of people from not even in our region. So there's a highly stressed situation. I don't want to be there. I don't want to do anything like, you know, I don't want to be away from my family. I'd rather just be, you know, have normal existence. But at the same time, I'm not wanting to take away people's rights. I don't want to, I still believe in the, like, some of the fundamental stuff of being Canadian and just allowing people to have choices, you know, like, that's still important to me. And so whatever response there was, like, that's, that directly was affecting my life. And so when I'm coming out and saying, hey, you know what? I think the kids are okay. I think the kids could go back to school. You know, this is coming from a perspective of someone that's actually in it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So all those naysayers, all those people that the epidemiologists that have never walked in a hospital, never seen a COVID patient. Remember that. Mm-hmm. Like, this was life. I'm intubating, putting someone on a ventilator that has COVID. I'm this far away. I'm 8 inches away from their face. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's me.
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Yeah.
There, go ahead on your TikTok, Twitter comments. Yeah. Come and step in my world for 3 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, my partner, she's a ICU nurse, a CV ICU nurse, and you know, one of my best friends, he's an RT, and it's like everybody that I know that is in healthcare, that is in like acute care, that's in the hospital, seeing this shit, they all seem to have a very like similar viewpoint that you do. And yet everybody who's not in it seems to have their own kind of viewpoint that is that's always kind of shocked me. I've always kind of been like, what the fuck are you talking about?
But don't we all agree that it's a much more nuanced conversation than like picking one side or the other to buy in and go, it's got to entirely be this way or entirely be this way or it's wrong.
Yeah. It's like, vaccines are better for some, are more important for some than others. So some do masks work in some settings. Yes. In some settings, no. Like there's a lot of nuance to all of that, but to say like, you have to be absolutely one way for everybody. Like some people need a booster more than another.
Yeah.
And so my whole point of view of having these honest data-based decisions is that you put your resources into people that need it the most. Like, I'll give you an example. Same time last year, we're doing the booster campaign, right? In Ontario. They were like, we're opening it up to everybody. Okay. You would have an 18-year-old that is savvy and finding the website, knows how to book his vaccine, his booster online. Meanwhile, I'm having New Year's Day breakfast with a 70-some-year-old guy that can't figure it out and is not going to get his vaccine for 3 weeks later. 70-year-old guy with diabetes. Ooh. The guys that we were seeing in hospital.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's insane. So, like, this is why it's got to be data-driven. This is why we got to be honest with people and just say, like, hey, yes, it's good that it's available, but these are the people that really need it. You know what I mean?
I've been thinking a lot about this from a public health communications perspective. I feel like one of the challenges is that in order to make a community of people feel safe, you have to communicate with confidence that you're giving them this sort of reassurance that the information you're communicating is fact. And so I found, especially during COVID, that a lot of the communication was communicated with this like level of certainty where it's like, this is the fact or this is the truth. But a lot of the science was like, yeah, we're still sort of unsure about this. We're still collecting the data. And science is an evolving process where, you know, you do experiments and you test hypotheses and you find out if that's true or not. And if there's correlations or like sometimes you can't prove that correlations are causations. And so with this, like with science being, you know, having a certain level of uncertainty to it, but public health communication having to be this sort of like confident truth, like source of truth to make a population trust them, it feels like the two sort of are at odds with one another. And so I'm curious, like, what you think in terms of how we communicate during these crises to make people feel like they can trust public health and that they're safe, but also being honest with them about the real situation and the reality of what we're going through.
That's a really good question. And I have a relatively strong opinion on this, and I don't know if it's right. I'll preface it by saying I don't know if it's the right move, but I think if you leverage that this is an absolute truth too hard, next time you need to lean on folks, they'll be like, remember when they told us X, Y, Z?
Yeah.
So my philosophy, just like with my patients, just with like my friends, my family, I'll bust out. I'll say like, listen, I think, well, if you choose masking, whatever intervention you choose, I think this is effective. Do I know for a certainty it's going to work 100% of the time? I don't think so. But I think this is a reasonable way to reduce your risk. And for the sake of just trying to get through this, please go ahead and mask. Please go ahead and get that vaccine, because I think this is what makes the most sense for all of us.
Mm. I think, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, to be humble, and but at the same time to lean on people and just say, like, or almost like lean on a sense of duty without
dictating.
Like, dictating, yeah. You know, like, I'm like, if I hear that message, if I'm trying to put myself on a non-medical perspective and say, this is what people are telling me in this time of crisis, when I know all these people are hustling, these people are dying, I'll get behind that. Mm-hmm. And even if it's instead of, say, the vaccine time, instead of 96%, or we'll say like instead of 89% of people get it, now that number is 83%, but you still have public trust in public health. Mm-hmm. That to me is so important, because this is a long game, son. Like, this isn't just like one point in time where we're going to need public health or the people to trust public health.
Yeah.
Look at kids' vaccines right now. The lowest it's ever been. Like, the anti-vax crew has leveraged a lot of this shit. Like, this is what, like, we got to think the long game.
Yeah. That was something that I thought that I had sometime last year, was like, I wonder what the long-term effect that this is going to have on child vaccine rates with parents people that were really heavily influenced to the anti-vaccination sort of side of things during this whole COVID experience. And like, what does that look like 10 years from now in terms of like who's vaccinated for, you know, a lot of the things that we've been, that 90% of the population has been routine or more has been routinely vaccinated against for decades. And what does that look like? And do we open ourselves, do we end up opening ourselves up unknowingly, you know, in a decade to something that we used to have eradicated, and
people fucking hate being told what to do.
Totally. Too. And the last question that you asked Brian and you answered Quadro is, that I had a thought on, was like, I also felt that in the public health communication, not everywhere and not everyone, but it seemed like at certain points there was sort of when maybe something came up that was like, oh, maybe we should rethink this policy, or maybe we should rethink this mandate, maybe, and there was some evidence to support rethinking that there was some digging in of the heels.
Big
where the best thing that could have happened for trust in public health would have been to say, hey, let's rethink this.
But I think that they thought that by looking like they're flip-flopping right. and changing their minds is actually they, I think they thought that that would decrease trust when I think that you're probably right in that it would have increased trust by showing like, hey, you know, maybe we got this a little bit wrong, or maybe at, maybe now things are changing and should be approached a little bit differently. Even if like what we were doing was right at the time based on the evidence, now things have changed, so we should probably change.
It's kind of like the same fallacy with politics and politicians, where like not changing your mind in politics is somehow something we should revere. It's like, yeah. you haven't changed your mind in 20 years? That's crazy.
It's fucking stupid.
Yeah. How have you not changed your mind in 20 years?
Yeah, especially when the evidence changes.
Yeah, I hope this is something our youth pick up on too. Like the ability to pivot, the ability to be open-minded. Like, I mean, I personally value this tremendously in a leader. Like the one that almost is, you know, if you're leading and you're almost, you don't care as much as how you're coming across as what the final product is or what the final results are. Like that to me is true leadership. Like it's not about you actually.
Yeah.
You're there to serve, motherfucker. Like,
yeah.
And do it proper.
Yeah. Mm. I had some, unless you wanted to stay on that.
I had one more thing to go down, but if you want to hit that, then we can do that instead.
I wanted to ask you something, Quadra. I'm on your Instagram page here, and I was taking a look through, and I noticed, searching
for the negative comments.
No. I was already on there, and I took a peek.
I was looking for them.
And I saw something that's been on my mind a lot, and then has reemerged big time in the public discourse lately, which I saw that you commented on, was the situation with Damar Hamlin and like a sudden cardiac event. For people
who don't know what that is,
that's exactly what happened at my soccer game,
right? And it's not uncommon. I mean, you see it in pro sports. It's something that a sudden cardiac event is something that as a self-proclaimed high performance athlete and works very hard and maintains very high cardiac output for a very long time. When I'm working out, I worry about that. I don't worry about it, but it's like, it's, you know, it's back here. It's going, is my heart going to stop today? I have no idea. I don't know what the influences are. I don't know if it's genetic. I don't really know much about it. And I probably should, because I'm working out at a high level all the time. And I'm just curious about.
Can you explain to people though who don't know what happened?
Damar Hamlin is a football player for the Buffalo Bills. He had a cardiac sudden cardiac arrest on the field. I guess from when we're recording this is probably 2 weeks ago, and it was really scary. And he was in intensive care for over a week and was unable to speak and was had help breathing. But from your perspective, Quadro, as an ICU doc. Like a sudden cardiac event like that happening, what are some of the factors and influences, and like what are you seeing from your professional perspective there?
Yeah, it's a big question. I'll speak to Damar's situation, and I'll talk about things in general. So Damar's situation was a unique one where he got the medical term is commotio cardis. Anyway, it's a direct blow close to your heart on a specific time of your cardiac cycle. So if you googled, it was based on the hit. Yeah.
Oh wow. Sure.
Like, I mean, this is it's all hypothesis, but everything seemed to correlate with it.
Yeah. When you see the hit, I mean, that makes sense. You see that hit and it's like shoulder, like straight to sternum.
Like launched and like, it too, eh? Like yeah, it was like a, almost unexpected that launch he put into him.
Yeah. It was like a car. He just like his chest got hit by a fucking truck. Yeah. Like it was crazy.
And he's built like an ox too. So if you googled like Chris Pronger, he gets a puck in the chest, gets up for a second and collapses. Same idea. Mm. Normally it's like baseball puck, some lacrosse ball. Mm-hmm. And usually the good thing about Damar was that he was witness. So witness being like everyone saw it happen, and so that he gets CPR right away. And then the defibrillator was placed as soon as possible. And the fact that it was a shockable rhythm and he got his rhythm back was extremely good news. And like, to put it into context, like he was dead for 10 minutes. And wow, because of the people that were on the field, the paramedics, all the medical staff, he's at home now and sounds like, my humble opinion is he'll play ball again, mm-hmm. but that's just an educated guess. But that it really, like, part of my reason I was platforming this a bit was just to encourage people, like the value of CPR, the value of knowing how to resuscitate someone really is life-saving. And I've been at the hockey rink too, like to get more towards your angle, you know, middle-aged dude, weekend warrior, overdoes it and gets a heart attack on the ice. And I've seen it where they get shocked and luckily have positive outcome. But it's like, I was one of the funny things, like I, every time I go into a rink, I kind of like in my head, like, where is the defibrillator kind of thing? It's kind of,
I think about that every week I play soccer because I've told the story before, so I won't go into detail on it, but I was playing soccer like 10 years ago. And a guy had a sudden cardiac arrest on the field. Just like nobody, he wasn't hit. He was just standing there and just dropped. And we stood by him for 45 minutes. Nobody knew CPR. The ambulance took forever to get there. And he ended up dying. And so, so like from that experience, I feel like I'd say this to the guys on my soccer team, like every month or two, I'm like, hey, just FYI, if I ever drop on the field, fucking start doing chest compression. Because like, I, like if any of you guys do, I undoubtedly I'll start doing them. But like, I'm worried that some, like I think about it every time I go to soccer, I just have like a quick, and it's probably because of the trauma that I experienced, but it's like this moment in the back of my head where I'm like, fuck man, I just, it would suck.
Yeah.
It would fucking suck.
Is there any, like, you know, and you also hear of like some in the, I mean, not like any, not that a life has any more value just because somebody's younger, but like, I think at least on the surface seems to be something more tragic about when this happens to somebody who's like, you know, 16, 17 years old. Totally. And it's really hard to take in. Is there anything testable that somebody might be more or less, prone to having some type of event like that I'm thinking of like heart, like really high cardiac output stuff, like cycling, mm-hmm. rowing, skiing.
Taylor's worried running. For himself. He just wants to be able to test himself.
I was going
to
say, like most of this stuff, and I'm just, these are generalizations. So, you know, don't hold me to it. Those that are, you know, TikTok warriors. but usually it's going to be something that happens early on. So, and some of these conditions are genetic. So you'll know if there's sudden cardiac death in the family before, that's a sign. If they've had structural heart problems, that's a sign. So one, like if it's a conduction problem or if there's a structural problem, usually you have symptoms or you hear about it early on. Like, so in their teens, like there would be a sign that there's an issue here. Like getting into later on in life, usually from a genetic point of view, you're probably, most of us are pretty good. Mm-hmm. Then you got to start worrying about, like, you just have like cardiovascular disease. Like you have clots in your like poor circulation within your heart. That's when you hear about the heart attacks amongst at the hockey rink. And usually those are guys that are, you know, typically late 30s onward that aren't cycling every day. They're usually the weekend warrior kind of thing. And usually have a metabolic syndrome. Like maybe they have high blood pressure. Maybe they have a little bit of pre-diabetes. But
people who are at risk because of like just a higher risk because of age. Their age is just elevating their risk.
They have risk factors, right?
Right.
So usually, like I'm just thinking in Taylor's spot, you're feeling good, looking good. You're not the one that we're worried about. If you were doing that every 2 weeks, you got a little bit of chunky chunk in the belly, end up
the factors are starting to build up in that case.
Yeah. And really, that was a two part for Taylor asking that. One part was him wanted to
and
just
thanks
make
for
sure
saying
he
that
was,
I look good.
He was just wanted to make sure he was okay.
I wouldn't honestly. I can't. You can't tell in that
I got a big baggy sweater.
Yeah,
right
that
now,
sweater, but. When y'all I saw y'all at the airport, y'all were looking fit and trim, yo.
not this guy. Not this guy. I'm the fattest I've been in my entire
Jared,
life.
Jared's beefing up in all the right ways.
No, you were beefed up too. No, you're looking good.
Yeah. Well, it was only 12 months ago that I was 25 pounds lighter. Tricaft has made me. I'm packing the pounds. I went to the CF clinic yesterday and. I weighed in at 165 pounds. It's the most I've ever weighed in my life.
You were like...
When you met me, I was 138, probably 140.
Yeah, and for being 5'2", like that's pretty heavy.
Six foot. But when I went in yesterday, I was like, they were like, how's your health? And I was like, fuck, man, like it's great. I was like, my lungs are doing good. Like I just had a lung infection. My PFTs were like 80%.
Yesterday?
Wow. Wow. After having like a serious lung infection like a week ago. And I was like, but also I'm 165 pounds. And last time I came in, I was 158. And the time before that, I was I was like 140. And all because of this drug that I'm on. And I was like, yo, is this going to like peter out? Like, am I going to plateau? And they were like, well... you're getting older now. Like, this is something we never really had to think about with CF patients. Like you're getting older. They were like, are you still like, what's your diet? And I was like, I'm just same as my fucking CF diet, like high calorie, high fat. And they were like, you can change that now. And I was like, oh yeah. And they're like, yeah, like, don't worry that, you don't have to be like slapping fucking butter and peanut butter on everything you eat anymore. And I'm like, all right, well, I guess
say goodbye.
That'd be hard to say goodbye to, though. No.
Dude, it's so hard.
Dude, you're gonna have to go from craft beers to like Miller Lights.
I mean, that was the other thing. I was like, how much? Yeah, they were like, how much beer are you drinking? I was like, too much.
Can you imagine after legit busting out Miller Lights? Like that's like the oh my god, that's like the that's opposite it. Of joy. I gotta punch somebody, give them the American light beer.
Gotta move on to the Natty Lights, I guess. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yo, Quadjo, dude, you're one of our favorite repeat guests. We have a couple that like come on every so often, but dude, you are a gem. We love fucking chatting with you. I think it's been too long since we had you on last, and I think the next time we get you on, there's some other stuff that I want to talk to you about, especially when like we don't have time to hit it today, but like, again, like I was saying, my partner, she's a CVICU nurse, and. When I talk to her about her work, it's always a hard conversation because I'm sure this can be said for healthcare across Canada, but in Nova Scotia right now, the healthcare system is an absolute fucking dumpster fire. There is so many issues happening right now. I think it was just today they just released. Tim Houston had a big meeting to talk about like
emergency measures.
Emergency room like shit show that's going on here. I would love to get you on soon again, just to talk about like the current state of healthcare in Canada, because it's a very hot button topic right now across the board from coast to coast. We'll save that conversation for another day. Quadjo, give yourself a little plug. I know it's at Quadcast pretty much all across the board, but how can people find you? How can people stay up to date with the work you do?
No, I appreciate the love, boys. And just a selfish plug too. That exact topic, I'm going on CBC National. I think it's February 1st.
Sweet.
Or January 30th or February 1st, just to talk about that exactly, like how we remedy a lot of this stuff, like the current state of healthcare and how we remedy it. But follow us anywhere you on any social media. Our biggest ones on TikTok at Quadcast. Our podcast is called Solving Healthcare, and we jumped on the Substack train actually, where so quadcast.substack.com, where you get our newsletter, video content, our podcast content. Like, so it's all housed in one spot, and it's juicy.
Cool.
Full of knowledge.
I love that. I love Substack too.
Yeah, Substack is a very cool platform.
Yeah. No, but I appreciate you guys tremendously for having me on. This is always a lot of fun, boys.
Oh yeah, always.
Good to see you, dude. Take care.
Take care.
That is it for this week's edition of Routine Checkup. Thank you so much for tuning in, folks. It means the world to us. And if you'd like to continue listening to the podcast, you can do that right here on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And of course, if you want to support the podcast further, you can leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, or you can simply rate the podcast on your Spotify mobile app. And even better than that, why don't you tell someone that you know, tell someone that you love, tell someone that you don't know that you listen to Sick Boy Podcast and recommend it to them, because we always love those extra ears. The podcast is produced and hosted by myself, Jeremy Saunders, Brian Stever, and Taylor McGilvery. The podcast is managed by Jeffrey Lonis at Talent Bureau. The theme music for today's episode comes from Rich O'Coin. Thanks again, folks. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back next week. That's it for now. My name is Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.